Welcome to The Parrot Unbound. This is Grace, the Library and Community Relations page. You're about to listen to an edited version of Piper Bartlett Brown's October 16th Polar Trek talk. Since you can't see them, we took out some of the videos that Piper played during the talk. If you would like to learn more about local sea level rise, do check out Strawberry Bank's YouTube channel to view a video Piper showed during the talk about flooding and its impact on historic structures. More information about Piper's work is available through her Instagram, at PolarPiperNH. Happy listening.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Thank you so much for coming. My name's Laura. I'm the Public Programming and Community Relations Librarian here at Portsmouth Public Library. We are super excited to welcome Piper Bartlett Brown here, who's kind of making the rounds of the Seacoast area to tell her story of what she got up to this summer. The library has a commitment to sustainability. You are in a LEED certified building right now, so we're really excited to bring more programs here to talk about sustainability and climate change. We also really support hands-on learning and lifelong learning, so we really felt like this fit in with the library's mission. I'm really pleased to welcome Piper Bartlett Brown. She was accepted this spring to the Polar Trek program and was one of only 12 teachers in the country. Yes, let's applaud that because it's awesome. So these teachers are invited to go on 3 to 6 week expeditions in the Arctic or Antarctic, which is what Piper will be talking about today. But this isn't the first sort of hands-on learning that she's gotten up to. She serves on the Teacher Advisory Council at the New England Aquarium and runs a science internship program for high school students in collaboration with the University of New Hampshire. She has personally participated in research to the RETE program, where she worked on the Living Bridge project, looking at the effects of pollutants and potential environmental impacts on local watersheds. Piper's teaching philosophy is to encourage students to engage in hands-on activities that generate data to investigate the application of academic concepts to real-world scenarios. She seeks to connect her students directly with the scientific community in order to foster enthusiasm and awareness, thus encouraging them to see themselves as genuine contributors to science. Piper has a passion for the outdoors, and living in New Hampshire gives her the opportunity to hike and ski. She enjoys traveling and exploring the underwater world through scuba. Piper's excited to have had this opportunity and to bring her experience back to her students and to us. Let's give a round of applause for Piper.
Thank you for that introduction. Oh, the microphone. My name is Piper Bartlett Brown. I'm a high school teacher at St. Thomas Aquinas High School in Dover, New Hampshire. So tonight the median age is a little higher than my normal audience, so it's refreshing, it's nice. But I'm here to talk a little bit about my Polar Trek expedition that I participated in this year, and we'll talk a little bit about the program, what it's like to do an expedition, and then we're going to talk a little bit about science and the implications that this has for my classroom and kind of the general public. Polar Trek, the TREC part of Polar Trek actually stands for Teachers and Researchers Exploring and Collaborating, and that's exactly what this program does. So these are some pictures from some other teachers who have participated. I just wanted to mention that there was a lot of women on this trip. There were 40 researchers on my expedition, and it was really nice to see women in science represented here, and this is just a small snapshot of that group. And so this program is really aimed at trying to get teachers and researchers collaborating and working together to talk about science, how science is done, and bring those things to the classroom. So giving them hands-on, real-world, tangible data that they can work with, and they can see these scientists as, you know, real people, professionals, and really see where their science textbooks are coming from. It's happening in the field, and so that's the whole point of this program. Like it was mentioned, there are 12 of us, so every year 12 teachers from around the country get chosen, and this is polar research, so you're either going to the Arctic or Antarctica. It kind of just depends on which researcher chooses you. It's a very long process. There's interviews and essays and multiple interviews, and all kinds of stuff that kind of go into this program, but it's really great to kind of be a part of it and be with these 12 amazing teachers who are like-minded and have these same goals as you for your classroom. There are a few teachers out right now. There's one in particular that I'll mention just for people who are interested. There's a project called Mosaic. This is Katie Gavenis, and she's out of Homer, Alaska. She's doing the Mosaic project, which is basically this one-of-a-kind research project where they're taking a ship and they're freezing it up in the Arctic, basically at the North Pole, and letting it sit there for a whole year and just letting it float with the ice floes, and researchers are going to be flying in and out to get to it and doing research throughout the year. So that's kind of a cool project. So she's out there right now putting that ship into the ice. So when I was chosen for this program, like I said, there's 12 of us. We get to meet one time. So in March, I went up to Fairbanks for a week-long training. So this was kind of what is expected of the program, what do we have to do, what are the expeditions going to be like. We heard from alumni, all this other stuff. But it was really cool to kind of get together with these 11 other people, and it's the only time we were all together. We, you know, did activities. We went to the pipeline, we went downtown, the most northern part of the Alaska Railroad, saw the Northern Lights and a couple of other things that we kind of got to do. But this was not a vacation. My kids were like, yes, like you're going on vacation for a week. And that's not what it was. It was like 9 to 5, paperwork and everything else, getting fitted for outfit or for equipment and stuff like that. So, but it was really awesome. And again, the only time I got to all be together. So I left at the end of July of this year, and our port of call was in Nome, Alaska. So I was on a U.S. Coast Guard cutter ship, Keeley, for 4 weeks, 3.5 to 4 weeks, which is a 420-foot ship. And our port of call was Nome, so we had to go all the way to Nome to get on this giant ship. So I had to go to Nome at the end of July, and I spent actually a week there working at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, the Northwest campus, which is in Nome, a very small town, and worked with a group of students there, Ecology Explorers, that do a summer program. And these are middle school, high school kids. This is the group. It's pretty small. The population of Nome is only about 1,000 people, unless it's the Iditarod, and then it's 30,000. But it's usually only 1,000 people. Main Street is bumping, as you can see. That's like midday. There's nobody there. This was really neat, an interesting community to work with. And I really wanted to see and work with these Alaska Native students. They created these flags, which I have some examples of over here. And then I took them on the ship and took photos with them and posted them on the blog so the kids could see them and follow the expedition. It was pretty neat. And I actually used to live in Juneau, so I worked with the Alaska Native community before in nature education, and they always knew more than me. And I had a feeling that these kids would know more about climate change than I did, and I was right. In their small or short lifespans, they've seen quite a bit of change in the way that they live and their lifestyle and how their community has changed in just the last decade or so. A little bit about life on the Healy. There's some things on this ship that you wouldn't normally think of. Gym, laundry, store, there's a barbershop, 4 meals a day, so there has to be a gym. We also had fun things like morale events, like trivia. You're kind of on this ship with 40 other researchers, and we're also on there with about 80 Coast Guard folks. And so had to have morale lights like trivia. We had sumo wrestling one night, which was pretty funny, for a $50 Amazon gift card. We got real jazzed out. And so it's just kind of fun, but it was really interesting to kind of work with all these researchers and also get to know the Coast Guard, which I know or did not know anything about. So it was really interesting to see that demographic too, and how researchers and the Coast Guard work together to achieve our goals basically on this expedition. 3 people to a room. There's my room, top bunk, yeah. Sun never set, so these curtains were extremely important because it was always sunny in there. And they're 24-hour science teams, which we kind of worked in shifts. And although I was the only teacher on board, I was assigned a shift, like any other researcher or any other person on the ship. And I was responsible for being where I needed to be and collecting the data that I needed to collect and all that kind of stuff. I was really a part of this research expedition, and that's kind of the whole goal of Polar Trek, is to immerse teachers in this experience. What is research really like? How does the scientific process really work? And how can you implement that in your classroom? Safety was a big thing on the ship as well. Anytime we were on the deck, we have to wear these lovely Mustang suits. So this would be on the back deck, steel-toed boots, helmets, and these Mustang suits. I will say it was warmer than I thought it was going to be. It was supposed to be really cold. I packed for cold weather, and it only got to be about 40 was the lowest. So we were sweating in these Mustang suits because they are really well insulated. The other great thing about working with the Coast Guard, not only was it just kind of interesting to get to know them and see how involved they were in the science, we also got to see a lot of cool Coast Guard operations. So there's a helicopter on the boat. They had small boat operations where they would basically go out and get things. So there was a bird survey group on the ship that I'll talk about. And anytime we saw a dead bird, they'd deploy this small boat and go get it for them. Our ship also broke at one point, so we had to have this part actually dropped from this plane, and they had to take a small boat out and get it. This is an actual company in Alaska that does this. They literally just fly around and drop stuff into the water and you go get it, and that's how some people get their packages. So that's how we got our boat part, was by airdrop. All right, so now talking a little bit more about the science. So the specific group that I was working with was the Northern Chukchi Integrated Study, and this was with Dr. Lee Cooper and Dr. Jackie Grubmeyer out of the University of Maryland. So this was the group that I was primarily working with. So I mentioned that there were 40 researchers on this boat, but we're all the researchers were doing different things. So it wasn't just the project that I was working on, it was other things like marine mammal surveys, ocean acidification, harmful algal blooms, and a number of other things. So I did get to be involved with all these different research projects, but my primary one was with Lee Cooper and Jackie Grubmeyer. This project was part of the Distributed Biological Observatory, or DBO. The Distributed Biological Observatory has to do with this map. We started in Nome, which is here on the peninsula, right there, and then we sailed south into the Bering Sea, past St. Lawrence Island, and then we sailed back up to about box 6, if you can see that there, and we went a little bit farther north than that. Those boxes are part of the Distributed Biological Observatory, and that is areas that are basically chosen for their high biodiversity and biomass. Dr. Jackie Grubmeyer especially, Jackie and Lee are married, but they have different last names. They've been working in the Arctic since the 80s. So Jackie got her PhD doing benthic, which is bottom organisms in the Arctic, in 1984, something like that. So they've been working in this area for a long time, and they created this DBO because what they wanted was they wanted to have scientists basically go to these areas and do all of their data sampling, because that's where the high biomass and high biodiversity in those ecosystems are. So they created this DBO. So that was the whole point of this expedition, was to hit as many of these boxes as we could and do all of our sampling there. So all of the research groups, including the one I was with, did all of their sampling at those what are called stations. On our way up, I was so bummed that everybody was like, "Oh, you're going to see all this sea ice. It's going to be amazing." And we didn't see any. And we'll talk about the implications of that with a lot of the research and the ecosystems that are up here. So the benthic team. So this is the group that I was with. Benthic means bottom. So we're basically taking organisms off the bottom, and we're collecting mud and organisms to determine productivity, biodiversity, biomass, and oxygen demand. So we're basically looking to see what's down there and how much of it is down there. And the reason why that's important is because these benthic organisms feed a lot of the higher trophic levels. So walrus, gray whale, a lot of those really big, beautiful species are actually fed by a lot of these kind of mud-dwelling worms and invertebrates and things like that. When we bring this stuff up, we put it into a wooden box or a sieve, and we basically wash off all the mud and then look and see what's left. And they take that stuff back to the lab. So we're going to start talking a little bit more about this science stuff. I will say all of the data from this cruise or this expedition has not been officially published or organized yet. I can tell you about the trends that they are seeing now, but as far as this year, I can kind of tell you what I experienced, and I'm pretty sure from what I've seen, the trends are going to continue with what they're seeing. So how are we grabbing the stuff off the bottom? We use something called the Van Veen grab, basically this giant metal claw that goes down, and they open it up on the deck, and then it gets lowered down, and the weight on the top closes it up, and it grabs this 0.1 meter squared area of mud from the bottom. It weighs about 117 pounds, so it takes a couple of Coast Guard guys to get this thing down. And the contents, like I said, will be put into a sieve and cleaned to identify for biodiversity. So once all that mud is cleaned off, we grab those organisms and it goes back to the lab. Again, this year's data has not been published or gone through yet, but the team has seen a reduction in biomass. And in the last few years, including amphipods, which are food for gray whales. So amphipods are a big thing because that's where gray whales come up to migrate, eat those. And they're seeing that reduction. So they're basically trying to figure out, is it a reduction, or are these organisms moving somewhere else? Because it's going to determine where these organisms have to move or migrate to get food. Do they have to go farther north? Do they have to go to a different area? And so that's what they're really looking at. But they're seeing a decline in this biomass. So some of the things that we do find in these Van Veen graves is some close-up images here. There's a brittle star, just kind of a sea star that you would see. We see a lot of worms, and they have kind of these little bristles where they go and poke their little bristles out, and that's how they filter feed the water. These clams are a big one, so there's a couple of different species. And so these are really important because these are huge food sources for walrus and eider ducks, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that later on as well, and how the distribution of these clams is actually changing where those animals forage for food. And there's a sun star, and then these are the amphipods that those gray whales eat. So they're pretty large, and the gray whales are actually filter feeders, so they will go down and grab giant mouthfuls of the mud, sift out the mud, and then keep these amphipods. When they come out, they're this really, really beautiful color. One of the other things that we'll do on the benthic team is take cores. So we're taking we take these giant grabs of mud, and we're also taking cores. So the HAPS core is taking a vertical mud sample, so you can see it here. Basically just goes down, it has a heavy weight on the top, punctures the mud, and then a foot comes down and basically brings this back up so that it looks like this. So this is what it looks like when it comes back up, or these HAPS cores. And they're looking at the rate of oxygen consumption. So oxygen consumption means that there's animals there. And if there are animals there, that means there's a food supply there for other animals. So they'll basically look to see how much oxygen, put an oxygen sensor inside this water section here, and see how much water, the rate of oxygen that gets consumed in that little, basically, puncture of the mud. So again, just looking at biodiversity and biomass. One of the things that's been affecting this biodiversity and biomass is the water temperature. I'm definitely gonna touch on that here. One of the things that we're seeing is these are our just kind of normal currents in this area. So the Bering to the Chukchi Sea, Bering Strait is very, very fast. It's a pinch point. But we see all of this basically warm water from the south starting to kind of creep up and affect these areas up here. So the currents are starting to take a lot of the warm water from the Pacific and bringing them up. So we're seeing an increase in water temperature from that, as well as just kind of climate change, heat being added. So this is some of the data. This is 2000 to 2012. This is the biodiversity biomass data from Jackie Grebmeyer's work. Like I said, the last couple years have not been organized, so she doesn't have any data for that yet. But this is what we're seeing. So overall biomass at DBO sites, this actually data goes back up to 2016, so it's a little bit more recent, but you can see this just general decline in the biomass at each one of these sites. So for example, however, you see, and these are tend to be correlated with the temperature. So if you look at 2007-ish, we have kind of a spike in the biodiversity or biomass of these organisms. And you kind of see how that's related here to the lower temperature. So these organisms are sensitive to temperature changes, and they haven't had time to adapt to some of these extreme temperature changes that we're seeing. And so they're suffering in the warmer years. Some of the other data that gets collected on the ship, there's something called a CTD, which is a conductivity, temperature, and depth sensor. We took a variety of measurements with this instrument, and it goes down basically every time we stop. On here, you've got what are called Niskin bottles, and these bottles are capturing water. So there's 24 of them along there. And basically what they can do is by computer, they can close them at different depths. So if a researcher is looking at oxygen content at 200 meters, they can set the computer so that it closes it at 200 meters and collects the water for that researcher. So we're looking at conductivity, which is salinity with this instrument, temperature, depth, and then we're also able to collect water samples with this. And you can see it's pretty tall. That's me standing on it. It's a really large instrument. It has its own room in the ship. Pretty interesting stuff. So this was happening at all of our sites many, many times. This was a big part of that. So sea surface temperatures, this is 2019. So this is June of 2019. So this is right before I went. And you can see that there's quite a difference in this area. So here's Bering Sea here, the Bering Strait, and the Chukchi Sea. So this is the difference, departure from normal. So we're seeing a huge rise, especially in this area here. So 6.5 degrees Celsius higher than normal. And I will say on the ship, when we were there in August, there were some areas that were 10 degrees Celsius above the normal. So we're seeing this wide range of temperature difference, and it's getting warmer up there for sure. Part of it is just kind of CO2 being added to the water, and it's warming that up. And the other part, too, is those currents bringing warm water up from the Pacific. One of the other teams that we're working with here in the DBO are a plankton team. So this is Janet Duffy Anderson from NOAA. And they were looking at Arctic cod specifically. So they use these large bongo nets. So at all those sites, DBO 1, 2, they were collecting this data with us as well. And so their data is going to help determine if the Arctic cod species is being outcompeted by subarctic species moving north. So we're starting to see kind of a shift in some of these fisheries, which in Alaska, as well as here, our fisheries are really important. So when we see a shift, it warrants some research. So that's what she's doing here. Arctic cod tend to thrive in colder water. So as those temperatures rise, they're gonna maybe see, the jury's still out because the data hasn't been actually analyzed yet, but they're thinking that those populations are gonna decline because of that. One of the other groups that was out there sampling at our DBO sites were harmful algal blooms. These guys are actually at a Woods Hole. So this is a lab out of Woods Hole. E.D. Vachon is at the Anderson lab there. And they're studying harmful algal blooms. Harmful algal blooms are photosynthetic, so they feed on the sunlight. So as we lose sea ice, they get exposed to sunlight. And so they're able to grow, they're able to bloom more often, more frequently, and more extremely. And so they're looking at these organisms, specifically Alexandrium species, which give you parasitic shellfish poisoning. So not a good thing to have, and they're really looking to see how this is affecting the ecosystem as well. And these have overwintering spores. So what we did with the benthic team is we're grabbing stuff off the bottom. These Alexandrium spores actually sit on the bottom and they'll overwinter there until conditions get better. And then they kind of float to the top and grow and create this bloom. So when we were doing our mud samples, we were also collaborating with this HABS group so that they could look to see what kind of cysts or overwintering cysts were in the mud at that time. So this is 2018 data for the harmful algal bloom group. And so again, like I mentioned, reduced sea ice means more photosynthetic opportunities for these harmful algal blooms. And also increased ocean temperatures is helping with that as well. So you're getting more of a severity. So you can see in some of these areas, so the bigger circles here are more harmful algal blooms. So that's where they're seeing these blooms. So this was last year, but you can kind of see these areas here that are affected kind of throughout the summer. And we were seeing these blooms basically in the same places this year. So I think that trend is gonna continue with what you're seeing here. The National Snow, Ice, and Snow and Ice Data Center, this is a really great resource if anybody's interested in seeing where sea ice is or what temperatures are doing or things like that, because these guys are out of Boulder, Colorado, and they do a really great job of creating these images and this data that's really user-friendly and easy to see. So I have a couple of pictures up here. Sea ice extent from August, so this is when I was here, I showed this earlier, and this is almost right now. So this was the end of September when they posted this, and I'm sure by now they have an October one. And you can see how it's reduced a little bit, but not too much. And then here's our Arctic sea ice extent over a couple of different years. So 2019 is our blue, so it's one of the lower ones, which isn't a great sign. 2012 was the lowest. This the dotted line is the lowest, and 2012 was a particularly bad year for sea ice. But 2019 wasn't great either, and like I said, I didn't see any, so I was kind of bummed about that. One of the other projects that was on the ship were something called Sail Drones. These are an independent company, saildrone.com. If you go to their website, they have some really interesting stuff there. And these are 20 feet tall and 20 feet long, so they're really big. So they have all these different sensors that are looking at oceanography, atmospheric, and things like that. They're wind-driven, they're solar-powered, and they're remote-controlled. So we can send them wherever we want, we can take whatever data we want, wherever we want, and these sail drones operate only in the summertime because there's no sun in the winter in the Arctic, so they can't run on their solar power without the sun. These are really cool, but basically when they're ready to put them in dry dock for the season, they just type it onto the computer, the coordinates, and the sail drones just sail to port. And so it's amazing what this technology is doing. And these have only been out a couple of years. So like I said, it's a private company and they're kind of keeping it private and they don't want to kind of sell or expand. So they're doing primarily scientific research and it's really neat to see. So this was 2018. This was the route of the sail drone. So you can just see automatically how much more ground that they can cover with these sail drones than we can on a ship. And it's a lot less time consuming, a lot less money, don't have to have people involved, all this stuff. It's just much easier to send these up here. One of the other things that was happening on the ship were moorings. So there was a team out of Japan, JAMSTEC, that was deploying moorings at some of these sites. So you can imagine how much science and how much activity is happening on the ship on a daily basis. It's just all of these different research teams and more doing things. There were also bird and fish surveys on this ship. So as we were going, Charlie and Linnea Wright, who are of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, were looking at seabirds. So there's some puffins up here, some least auklets. They're basically looking to identify the birds, where they are, where they're going, do they have food in their mouths, that kind of stuff. They're taking all of this data and mapping it as we go. So they only are looking at these birds when we're moving so that they don't like double count any birds. And so it's just kind of interesting. They spent all their time up in the bridge just observing birds, and it was amazing how quickly they could identify things. They're looking at population densities and diversity. Alaska had a big bird die-off this year, and they think it's mostly starvation, but the cause of starvation could be a number of different things, so they're not quite sure. That's part of the research that they're doing this year, is trying to figure out what's causing those birds to die off. Marine mammal surveys were also happening, so gray whales, orca whales, a little walrus here, those little tusks. And so we saw a lot of these guys. Again, no sea ice, so no polar bears, which was a good thing. If we saw a polar bear, it wouldn't have been a pretty sight. No sea ice. And this was an interesting story, too. This is actually a northern fur seal, and we saw this up in the Chukchi Sea, and their range only goes to about southeast Alaska, maybe Washington. Southeast Alaska is the highest. And I actually took this photo up in the Chukchi Sea. He was following the boat. But we actually sent it to the marine mammal research team, and they think that we basically identified a range expansion for that species. So that was kind of cool to see this guy out there looking for food. Walruses, you can actually tell the difference. There are some walruses that eat other seals, and you can tell the difference by their two front teeth. So this is actually not a seal-eating walrus, because it has kind of longer white tusks. The ones that eat seals kind of have like brownish tusks, and they're short. So we saw a couple of those as well. So whenever we saw a walrus, you could tell if they were kind of the meat eater version or if they're eating mostly the shellfish on the bottom. Gray whales, like I mentioned, very popular destination for them to go for food with those amphipods. And then we've got our orca whale pods as well. So I just want to mention this again because I want to talk a little bit more specifically about walruses and how the benthic organisms on the bottom are affecting these walrus populations, as well as the sea ice decline. Remember, we didn't see any sea ice, but we did see walrus. So you can see how these animals use this sea ice, and it's really important for their survival. They use it to mate, they use it to feed, all kinds of stuff. Most of these walruses are foraging off the bottom, so they're like just giant vacuums, and they'll grab these bivalves right off the bottom and eat those. The problem with that now is that when we have reduced biodiversity or biomass of these clams, which is what my benthic team has been finding and is currently seeing if that trend is continuing, these walruses are having to travel farther for food. So they're either having to move and shift where they're going because these bivalves are shifting, or they're having to find other food sources. So this is a study that was done. Here's a walrus haul out. So when there's no ice, they have to find some kind of land. They can swim for quite a few hours, quite a long time, but they can't do that forever. It costs them a lot of energy. So this is that same haul out. Here is a map, and it shows where these walruses are going to get some of their food. So some of the food, you know, some of the walruses, they can find food right offshore, but a lot of them had to go offshore to find these clams that they really like to eat. So wherever the clams go, these walruses are going. But as the sea ice declines, they have to swim out to these areas where the clams are, and so they don't have that ice to rest on and spend time on while they feed. So they're seeing this extra energy expenditure with these walruses. Another species that really relies on the benthic organisms, particularly those clams, are what are called spectacled eiders. And these are mainly on St. Lawrence Island, which is down here in the Bering Sea. And so they feed on these bivalves. Here's a large colony of them. And the distribution of these bivalves are really important. So there's kind of a problem with the temperature in two kind of ways for these bivalves. First, they don't really adapt to warmer temperatures very well. And also with warmer temperatures, they have more predators. So these bivalves are kind of being hit twice as hard by the warming temperatures just because they can't adapt quickly, and they also have more predators if it's warmer. There's more predators that are going to hang around and feed on those bivalves. So we're seeing a reduction in those clams, and so walruses and these spectacle biters are having a little bit harder time finding food. All right, sea level. We're switching it way up now. Sea level rise potential. So I get a lot of questions about this as far as the sea ice melting. Sea ice melting isn't really causing sea level rise because of displacement. That ice is already there. When it melts, it's really affecting the ecosystem, but it's not affecting sea level rise. But I do want to talk a little bit about it, because it does pertain to us, particularly here in Portsmouth. Glaciers and ice caps, you'll see this is a sea level equivalent rise in meters. If all the glaciers and the ice caps melt, might get like a 1.5 meter rise. Greenland, which is a big concern right now, you're getting over 10 meters, so that's 30 feet, that's high. And then Antarctica, oof. If Antarctica melts, we're looking at 70 meters more. Antarctica is an interesting one because there's not a lot of data on the melting of Antarctica. There's some science that they've seen. Some parts of it are melting and parts of it are actually growing. So they're not quite sure what the rate is and what's happening with Antarctica. So jury's out on that. But Greenland is definitely melting. So we're going to see these sea level rises. The kids in Nome are subsistence feeders, so a lot of them are. It's about $7 for a bag of Doritos in Nome, so a lot of people have to go out and fish, forage for their own food, and when I was there, they were saying that the reduction of sea ice is causing their families to basically have to look at different avenues to feed themselves. They're having a hard time going out and hunting during the winter months with the sea ice gone, so there's some pressure on them for food sources. And that being said, we are going to start seeing sea level rise. That's kind of our big thing. So in Nome, they're seeing sea ice decline and it's affecting their community. They'll see sea level rise as well. They're seeing things more drastically than we are. They have Arctic amplification up there, and they're seeing kind of these drastic changes with their climate because of that. So as the sea ice melts, the sea ice is white, and so usually that sea ice will reflect the sunlight. But as it melts, it's giving way to dark land and dark water. So more heat is being absorbed. So that's why the Arctic is actually seeing more climate change than we are. But we are susceptible to sea ice rise or sea level rise. Ice mass changes in Greenland, like I said, are pretty drastic. These red areas are where it's happening the most, where we're seeing the most melt per year. There's something called the King Tide, which is an extreme tide that we have. It's about 2 feet higher and lower than the normal tide, which, if we think about sea level rise happening here in New Hampshire, it's going to be that and more. So we can kind of look at the King Tide to say, okay, what is actually going to happen with our community here? So this map is the Piscataqua River, and there's something here called the Puddle Dock area, which is this low level of land where we get a lot of flooding. So if we have a King Tide, there's going to be a lot of flooding. This is where Strawberry Bank is. So we do see a lot of the sea level rise kind of in our basements. And there's also a study from Newmarket that talks a little bit about saltwater inclusion in people's water and their sewer and things like that. So sea level rise is starting to kind of happen, and we'll see that more here in this area as our kind of our effects. One of the other things that I got to learn about a little bit on this expedition was new shipping routes. So as the Arctic melts, creating new shipping routes. So there's a few ships that have already done this in 2018 and in 2016 have gone through the Arctic Sea as a shipping route. So instead of having to go elsewhere, they just go across the Arctic. And so new shipping routes are coming about, but that also means that we're going to have new fisheries there as well. So we have our EEZ boundary, which is public water basically here, and up until this point, the different countries will own those waterways. But this whole area is kind of the high seas, and so it's public international waters there. So over the years, we've had this reduction in sea ice, which means that we might have these potential fisheries there. And so a lot of countries are talking about this. What happens? What fish are going to be there? How are we going to regulate it? Because there are so many bordering countries, there's going to potentially be a lot of issues with fishing. So a couple of things that are happening. probably the most current thing. We've got 5 Arctic coastal states, so China, Iceland, Japan, Korea, and the EU, are basically saying they're not going to fish there. They need to do more science, and there's a large group of countries now that are actually doing research up here in the Arctic to look at those fisheries and check that out. So what are the implications for my classroom? So I just threw a lot of information at you. And so all these researchers are contributing to this distributed biological observatory in order to get a better picture of this ecosystem, to see what what the Arctic actually looks like, what's happening with climate change, which you're seeing change at a really high rate due to that. And so the implication for the classroom, so what is kind of our plan moving forward? We're hoping to, or we are creating a website for teachers to be able to use. So we're creating curriculum and working with each one of the individual researchers that I mentioned up here, as well as a few others, to get data, pictures, video, things like that, that they're willing to share with classrooms in their research. So we're putting those things up on a website so that teachers can actually use each of the individual research groups as a lesson plan, or they can use the whole website as a unit on Arctic ecosystems and climate change. So that's kind of what we're hoping to do with that. We're debuting it in February at a conference in San Diego. And I also am planning on going back to the North Pole for 2021 with this group to do a little bit more extensive research. It'll be a 6-week trip this time. My husband's a patient man, he'll be all right. And so that's kind of our plan to moving forward and hoping to get this stuff into the classroom. So I do teach marine bio, so that's kind of my goal for next semester, is to start kind of putting this stuff together and making it public for other teachers and using it in my own classroom. So this is kind of how you can reach me. I do have an Instagram where I kind of do a lot of educational climate change things. If you know a teacher that wants to collaborate, if you know a teacher who's interested in a program like this, work for an organization that's interested in learning more, I'm so happy to go and do outreach. This is part of the program, is to go out and talk to the public, talk to schools, students. So I am available for all of that stuff, and I would love to hear from individual people and things like that. Yeah, and that's kind of my spiel. So if there are any questions?
As a parent of a high schooler, how are you making sure that other schools are learning about what you're doing? I know that you want to set up a website, but how are people in other states or other areas learning? That's the first thing. And then second, I'd like to hear about the internships that you are facilitating, and is it climate change related, or is it marine biology?
So as far as getting other schools to do this, so I reach out to a lot of schools and say, like, hey, I would love to come in, what's your age group, that kind of stuff, and I have done some school outreach things. I also do things like I'll be at the SECO Science Center on Veterans Day for a STEM night and doing that kind of stuff. There are a lot of Polar Chart teachers right now. This program's been around for about 15 years, so we basically continue to do this kind of outreach even though your expedition is done. The whole point is to continue to do that at schools and things like that. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Or did that answer your question, I should say?
Mostly, yeah.
And then as far as the internships go, that's a program that I run, so students actually choose who they want to work with. So it's through UNH, and they pick a researcher that they're interested in working with. So I give them that freedom. I don't dictate what they want to do because it's all about their interests. And then we work with that researcher to integrate them into their lab. So they'll go and do a whole year, do a project with that researcher. I've had students, or I do have students also present at the UNH Undergraduate Research Conference. So they actually go and have their poster and they do their research and present there as well. So there's that. So, and that's been going on for a couple of years. So this kind of collaborating with researchers and connecting students with researchers is a huge passion of mine, and I firmly believe that it's extremely beneficial. So that's what this program is for.
For just St. Thomas students, though?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, just St. Thomas students.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you, like I said, I'm willing, like, if you have a student who's interested in doing it and you want to pursue an internship and you don't know how to get in, like, let me know. I'm more than happy to help.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What departments at UNH are you working with?
It's mostly COLSA. But I have had, right now it's all COLSA.
What is that?
It's the College of Life Science and Agriculture.
Oh, okay.
So I have some students right now doing marine chemistry research. They just started a couple weeks ago, school just started up. I've had folks in the marine bio department doing clownfish research. I've had students doing engineering work, environmental work. Yeah, it kind of varies. It really depends on the kid's interest, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We watched a documentary in the last year or so that highlighted what's going on in Miami, Florida, with the saltwater intrusion, with the sea level rise. And the prediction is eventually the Everglades, which are the primary drinking water supply for the city of Miami, will go brackish. Mm-hmm. Everybody's going to have to leave Miami. Mm-hmm. And the prediction is we're all going to go to Orlando, so look out for Orlando. Disney's in trouble. You won't be able to get through Orlando anymore. And it's also causing the same problems, you know, with septic systems failure. And you know, in the documentary, they show kids in the poor neighborhoods playing when there's high tide and the water that comes up out of the storm drains, which is all polluted septic water, and they're playing in it. Mm-hmm. Deep trouble is coming.
Yeah, inclusion is a big one, especially around here. We're starting to see that. There's a new study actually out from UNH that talks about that, about some of the inclusion issues that we're going to have with people who have private septic and private water. Yeah. Thank you all very much for coming here.
Thank you.